This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
Siberia was blasting hot in May 2020, with some places almost 40 degrees Fahrenheit, 22 degrees C above average. Locals described skipping a season, going straight from winter into a hot summer. Massive forest fires in northern Russia erupted in the heat, releasing their carbon into the sky. Is this a case of global warming driving more global warming? During the pandemic, it's hard to get reports from the ground, but the satellite eyes in the sky are still working. I reached out to Mark Parrington, senior scientist and wildfire expert at the European Union's Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service, or CAMS. Mark told us about smoke from Arctic fires in a Radio EcoShock interview last September. Now Parrington and other experts worry these new fires, practically popping out of the snow, survived the winter to burn again. Zombie fires. But on the climate change angle, prepare to be surprised. Mark Parrington, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thank you.
Mark, please describe what a zombie fire is and why you and other scientists believe this could be happening.
A zombie fire is a catchy term for a type of fire which is often called a holdover fire or sometimes an overwintering fire, which is a fire that is no longer burning at the surface but may be occurring where there were fires in the last fire season that then burn at very low temperature. So they smolder underground through the winter months and then may resurface in the spring when any snow or ice has melted from the surface.
And why do you think it could be happening? What are the signals?
Well, we're focusing on fires in the Siberian part of the Arctic again. And what's been quite interesting is where some of the satellite observations have been showing active fires. We can zoom in and see in the visible imagery that there is smoke there. But they're occurring in places where we know there was fires last summer. And also they're occurring in places where just a couple of weeks ago, that land looked very frozen. And so the fact that they're coming on very quickly leads to speculation that they might be then ignited from these resurfacing zombie fires. Also, because they're happening in very remote locations, there are some human settlements there, but we don't know exactly what the source of ignition is, and that's what's leading the speculation that there could be these zombie fires.
Your paper notes that without confirmation on the ground, science cannot be positive zombie fires are happening. Where are these fires? Are they accessible? Can ground confirmation be arranged, or is that already happening?
Well, we know for sure that this type of fire does occur in Alaska, for example. There has been field work where they identify these fires and where they resurface. But the reason we're focusing on right at the moment is the Siberian part of the Arctic, where there hasn't been that ground confirmation or people on the ground going to observe those. And so without that, it's very difficult to say precisely what the ignition of those fires would be. And like I said, that's what's then hinting that it may be these kind of zombie or holdover fires.
Is the Arctic fire season extending in length?
It's difficult to say. I mean, last summer when we first started seeing that very extreme number of fires and the fire intensity, particularly in the Siberian Arctic. If you'd have asked me this concept of an Arctic fire season, then I would hesitate to call it a season as such. I mean, certainly through the summer months from middle of May through till maybe the end of September even, what we call the boreal fire season, so fires in the northern hemisphere in the boreal forests. And then obviously the Arctic region is an extension much further north from that zone. But even then, you would see that the sort of peak in the number of fire detections and the sort of duration of them would be around those same sort of months, except you wouldn't necessarily see such a clear increase in activity between them. It might be just a few days at a time over the summer months. Whereas last summer, what we saw from the beginning of June through till almost the end of August, elevated fire activity in the Arctic Circle, particularly over Siberia, which then starts to look much more like a season. But that still looks like 1 year out of the 17 years that we have data where it shows that kind of a daily trend.
Well, let's go to the tropics where 2 billion people live. How much carbon dioxide was released by tropical wildfires in 2019, and how does that compare to previous years or decades?
The data that we have, of course, is global for global fire activity. And what we've been paying most of our attention to over the last couple of months, well, from the beginning of the year, are fire seasons in the Northern Hemisphere tropics, particularly in Central America and the Upper Asian region of Southeast Asia. And so in terms of the carbon emissions, we're seeing approximately 15 megatons of carbon estimated for Central America. So that includes the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, all the way through Central America to Panama. And it also we also see from the Upper Asian region about 70 megatons of carbon. But if we put that in the context of the previous 17 years of data that we have, so we have a data set that goes back to 2003, actually those numbers are at fairly average levels. And actually we don't necessarily see a big degree of year-to-year variability in the total emissions estimated for the fire season.
In 1997 or 98, carbon from Indonesian peat fires reportedly made that developing country the number three source of greenhouse gases in the world behind the U.S. and China. What was the 2019 fire season like in Indonesia?
2019 fire season for Indonesia, it was quite interesting. It was at quite high levels through September and into October, and it's quite unusual because it wasn't an El Nino year. The El Nino Southern Oscillation was at relatively neutral levels during last year. But there was this other climate anomaly called the Indian Ocean Dipole, which was in a very strong positive phase, and what that meant was that it was much drier over Indonesia than it would normally be. And so we saw increased fire activity that in some days for a week or so was at the same levels as what we saw in, say, 2015. But then they did experience more rain through October. And so overall, it wasn't such a high year in terms of the emissions that we estimated from the fires.
Are the fires visible from satellites really wildfires, or were they started to clear away forests for palm oil plantations or mines or other human use?
I think this is a good question, and it's an important one to bear in mind when we're using satellite observations and looking at fires in the Earth system, because what the satellite is observing, or what the sensor on the satellite more precisely is observing, is actually a thermal anomaly. So it's an anomaly in the brightness temperature at the surface, which is when there's a heat source will register in the detector, and that's the information that we're using. And so it doesn't really distinguish between what the source of those thermal anomalies are. So it could be fires used for different purposes, so whether it's for agriculture, actual wildfires or forest fires, or other open burning. But it could also be from volcanoes. Gas flaring and oil flaring also show up in the sensor. And while we can try and take into account those non-fire-related signals, there are still the data that we do have then for fires doesn't really distinguish what the type of fire is burning.
When is the next tropical fire season, Mark, and are we able to predict how severe it may be?
Well, the tropics is quite interesting because of the tropics in the Northern Hemisphere. Most generally, they have their fire season is from sort of January through till April, May for that Upper Asian part of Southeast Asia and Central America. But then also the northern tropical countries of Africa have a fire season that is almost the exact opposite of what the Southern Hemisphere tropical African countries have. So basically from November through till May is the peak of the fire activity there. And then in the months, the 6 months in between, it switches to the Southern Hemisphere. So we are expecting to see an increase now in fire activity in Southern Tropical Africa. But then, of course, in Indonesia and then in the Amazon, their peak fire seasons will come through August, September, and October. And it's very difficult to predict how those are going to be. Again, I saw earlier this week that the forecast for the, or the seasonal forecast for the El Nino conditions is to be relatively neutral this year. And so in that respect, we may not expect to see such extreme fire conditions. But one of the missing variables that we cannot predict with any certainty is the ignition. So we know if they're agricultural fires, they'll be started at a particular time of the year after the wet season to prepare the land for growing crops. But then in terms of wildfires and anything on top of that, on top of those agricultural fires, it's really difficult to know ahead of time.
Are there countries, Mark, where carbon from wildfires is actually decreasing? And what is the bottom line for CO2 emission trends in the tropics?
So overall, in a worldwide sense, fire activity and fire emissions are decreasing year to year. And this is mostly driven by fire activity in the tropics. And the reason it's declining, or has been declining generally in a general sense since 2003, is because of how land practices and land management practices have been changing in the tropical regions. And so it's true that in some countries we are starting to see in recent years a generally upward trend in the fire activity. And in some places this upward trend has been observed for a much longer period of time. So, for example, from California and Alaska, they're seeing generally an increasing trend in the number of extreme fires. But then there are a lot of places around the world where actually the trend is either flat or declining.
Science itself is facing a challenge from the coronavirus pandemic. Some people would like to get teams together and put them on the ground in Antarctica or other places to do observations, and they're wondering whether that's safe to do. I'd like to get your personal opinion as a scientist. Will the pandemic affect your work, and could it make us more dependent on the eyes from space observations?
Well, clearly the pandemic and the lockdown effects taken on by governments to keep people safe is affecting everybody. And it's affecting my work as well. So the team that I work in, we're all now currently working from home and teleworking and meeting through video conferencing. But we have the advantage where we work mostly with computers and satellite data, and actually working like that is not so different to when we work together as a team. But I do have plenty of colleagues who go into the field regularly, and of course it's making their task much more difficult to be able to do that, to do the science and to do the measurements, but to be able to do that safely. And I'm also aware that in terms of wildfires and wildfire management, there are very real concerns in some parts of the world where how can you effectively manage and fight wildfires while maintaining a social distance. And so there's a lot of factors to be taken into account from a scientific point of view, but also a point of view of managing and controlling wildfires when they're threatening infrastructure and posing a risk to people and settlements. But everybody's having to learn to adapt and to manage as best as we can.
How can the public, my listeners, use Copernicus information to understand what is happening around the world?
Well, all the Copernicus data from all the data services. So I work in the Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service, and the organization I work for is the European Weather Center. We also have a Copernicus Climate Change Service. All of that data is completely free and open access, and so it can be downloaded and looked at by anybody that's interested. On the websites, there are now some tools which have been developed for being able to, rather than download the data directly to your computer, you can put it into a space in the so-called cloud and look at data in that way. And then we have a whole lot of support that's available for helping people to access the data and to understand it and to understand what it's showing in the application they might be interested in using it for.
Mark Parrington, thank you so much for sharing your time with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.